Hello, and welcome to another edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. I am Tom Reed, and joined, as always, by Dave Molinari. We will continue our look through the Metro Division today, focusing on the New York Rangers. We'll be joined by Larry Brooks of the New York Post, but training camp is finally underway. Dave, I'm assuming you passed your physical step in your skating?
Fortunately, we don't have to have physicals to gain admittance to the press box. I think I might fare a little worse on that than I did in Oriental art history in college. So I am hoping to use these next few weeks to really sharpen my adverbs, though. So,
you know, yeah, it's preseason for all of us. As we said, that things are going there. You got things going in Cranberry. Sidney Crosby is skating. I think we're the first to report he's not obviously practicing with the group per se, because his one wrist is still not quite ready to go. But at least it's a good sign that he's out there practicing with the boy. The captain's out there practicing with the boys. One person who we knew wouldn't be there, and if there were necessarily hopes of maybe some good news and quick healing, I think Penguins fans were maybe hoping for some good news with Evgeny Malkin. But Dave, when you guys met with Ron Hextall on Thursday, pretty much said December at the earliest, huh? Or 2 months? Is that was kind of the gist of it?
Yeah, at least 2 months. And just to clarify something so people don't get the wrong impression, Crosby is working out on his own.
Yeah, okay.
He's not practicing with the team.
Yeah.
And he's only practicing in the biggest sense of the word. It's mostly he's skating. You know, he's carrying his stick with his right hand, you know, not his left, which is the one that was surgically repaired. So yeah. Don't want to give anybody the impression that he either is back with the team or will be rejoining it, you know, any minute now. That I think is still a ways off. As for Malkin, though, I guess that Hextall probably gave us a hint that the news that was delivered on Thursday could be less than encouraging when he said that when they announced a while ago that Malkin would miss at least training camp. When the at least phrase cropped up again on Thursday, you know, there's reason to at least be a little pessimistic that it will only be the 2 months that Ron Hextall put on a time frame for his return, as camp was getting going. And so, yeah, it's certainly not what the Penguins or their fan base was hoping to hear, but, you know, they have to go where reality takes them.
Yeah, and Dave, we at the end of the season, at the end of the season, obviously Malkin had kind of come back, got ready for the playoffs. He was out late in the year, played in the playoffs, played all right. He played pretty well. Obviously, it was a quick in and out. And right at the end, we were talking about, okay, what's going to happen with him and Chris Letang? They're obviously two, you know, just indispensable players on this team, part of these three Stanley Cup wins starting in 2009. And we thought, okay, sometime later this summer, we'll hear contract extension talk for both of these guys. And the next bit is, as you alluded to, well, he's going to have surgery on his knee and is going to at least miss training camp. Now the talk of he may be out at least to December begs the question, Dave, if you're the Penguins, and this guy is without question a Hall of Fame player, one of the 5-10 most important players in the franchise history, he's also 35 years old and pretty obviously coming off a serious knee problem here. where are you with what they should do as far as contract? Because I'm wondering if you at this point start to think, maybe wait until the end of this season, even though you would then risk losing him. But do you think the Penguins would possibly take that approach with him, given you're not going to have a ton of time to see him next season and even before the trade deadline? Not saying that they would trade him, but where are you right now with what you would do with a contract with him?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be in any kind of rush to get a contract done. You absolutely, I think, would want to see him play for an extended period before you would even consider making a significant financial commitment to him, or even in terms of length of a contract. When a guy's in his mid-30s and coming off a major operation to a major joint, that's cause for concern and certainly reason to be cautious in how you proceed about, hitching yourself to that particular thoroughbred. The next contract that Evgeny Malkin gets is going to be based on projections of what he can contribute in the future, not what he's done in the past. And, the fact that he's, a pretty certain Hall of Famer shouldn't really affect, what kind of deal the Penguins give him or how quickly they give him one. In a salary cap era, a team that is flirting with the cap ceiling year in and year out can't afford to make a big money mistake. So I think it would be prudent of Ron Hextall to be very cautious and deliberate in how he approaches negotiations with Malkin's camp. And, I think that if, the Penguins would like to keep Malkin, they would like to have him and Crosby retire as Penguins. And I've never heard Malkin express an interest in playing elsewhere. So I think it just makes sense for all concerned to not rush into anything.
Yeah, and the other part of this too, and we knew this when Ron Hextall and Brian Burke were brought in here, is they are tasked with this really difficult thing of trying to keep contending with one eye to, at some point here soon, you're going to have to start looking at a real rebuild. And what complicates this in my eye is this is a team that's lost four straight playoff series. It's not a sense of, well, we bring Malkin back into the fold and we're right back in it. We're right there, one of the top two or three teams in the Eastern Conference. Not to say that they might still not be able to wring one more run out of this, but this is something that Ron Hextall has to kind of look at this with, okay, we're contending, but here in a couple of years, how much longer do we want this guy, just with where the team is right now?
Yeah, it might sound cold or harsh,
right?
But, the NHL is a business, and sometimes you have to make difficult business decisions. And, if Malkin would return to something close to full health, then he probably has a couple more productive years in him. He's not, he's not going to be the player he once was. That's not a reasonable expectation for a guy who will be moving on to the dark side of his 30s. But, it's his skills will not have totally deserted him. But if he has a knee that he can't rely on, you have to at least consider the possibility that, the future without Malkin as a part of it might be coming sooner than you would have liked.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's something that, Dave and Taylor will be monitoring all season and into maybe next offseason. So, all right, we're just getting started here on the 60-60-87 podcast. As we said, we'll have Larry Brooks a little bit later. We're going to get into some camp battles and some news around the NHL. Stay with us here on the 66-87 podcast. Welcome back to the 66-87 podcast. As we said, we will have a little bit later. We will continue our look around the Metro Division with a look today with Larry Brooks from the New York Post. But well, training camp is, as we said, is underway. And at this time of year, especially with what we just mentioned, the two biggest names of this team won't be out there on the ice early in the season. With Malkin, won't be out to December. So there's some more camp battles that maybe we would have expected, that at least in the summer. Dave, run us through some of the more intriguing battles for positions and for jobs right now on this roster.
Well, probably the battles that will get the most attention are the ones to replace Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin in the middle of the top two lines. Here in the early stages of camp, Jeff Carter seems like a pretty obvious choice to play on the first line where Crosby normally is. And at this point, you know, it seems logical to believe that Jake Guentzel and Brian Rust would be his line mates, although, you know, that's certainly subject to change if the coaching staff decides there are wingers who work better with Carter than one of those two. The real battle, and the really interesting one of the two, I think, is who will replace Malkin, because, you know, they don't happen to have a spare Malkin on the shelf. And, you know, you can't really read too much into early line or combinations early in training camp, but I found it kind of interesting that when camp opened, they had Teddy Bluger between Zach Aston-Reese and Brock McGinn, which is the line from last year with McGinn plugged into the Brandon Tanev spot.
All right.
Bluger is one of the people that those on the outside had kicked around as a possible second line, you know, fill in for Malkin. And I don't think you can rule out that possibility yet, but a guy I think that might get consideration for that is Evan Rodriguez. He's certainly not Evgeny Malkin, but, you know, he's a veteran, he's responsible, he's versatile, he's, you know, he's got decent offensive skills, and I think he could be a, you know, a capable placeholder, at least until Crosby comes back, at which point you could then drop Jeff Carter back onto the second line. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see about that. You know, they're also going to have to find a partner for Mike Matheson, since Cody Ceci has moved on to Edmonton via free agency. Kind of tough just yet to get a handle on who the front runner there might be. My inclination probably would be to give John Marino a shot at that, because I think he is has the kind of defensively responsible game that would allow Matheson to make the most of his offensive talents. But, you know, Chad Ruedel is a legitimate contender, I think. Mark Friedman might get a look there. So we certainly don't know how that's going to play out either. And then there are some spots on special teams. Crosby obviously is a fixture on the number one power play. Malkin got most of his power play work on the top unit. So, you know, there will be some new faces there. And you not only will have those new faces, but maybe, you know, we'll see Todd Reirden make some tactical adjustments to, you know, adapt to the changes in personnel. Still a little early in camp to see exactly what he might have in mind there. And, you know, the same is true. They lost two of their most relied upon penalty killers in Cody Ceci and Brandon Tanev, who ranked second and third respectively in most average shorthanded time per game last season. Both of those guys were, you know, well over 2 minutes each per game. And, you know, that's a significant amount of time that they're going to have to replace on a unit that wasn't all that, you know, spectacularly successful. So
is the thought, let's deal with this right away. Obviously early, and one of the guys that we talked about coming in on a tryout was Brian Mill. Do you think that he has a shot at making the team? Does it look like they're going to give him a legitimate shot of making this team?
Oh, I think they're absolutely going to give him a shot. I think things are almost weighted in favor, you know, here in the early stages of that, you know. They're almost pulling for him to make it. I noticed a couple of things. The first that struck me was they gave him a space in the main locker room, which is usually reserved for the returning letterman and the established guys. You don't often see guys on tryouts in the main room, you know, at the start of a training camp. Now, you know, perhaps that's just a show of respect for a 36-year-old guy who's played a lot of games in the league. You know, we don't know, but, you know, he's a good face-off guy. You know, the Penguins certainly need help in that area, and especially early on in the season. With Crosby expected to miss at least a handful of games, he's their go-to guy on draws. Being adept at that is something that will certainly help Boyle. So, you know, there's a lot of reason to think that they would like to find a space for him if he can show that he merits it, which, you know, will really be based, I think, on how he performs in the exhibition games, and then to a lesser extent in the training camp scrimmages.
Sure. Getting back to the top nine, you often hear coaches, when teams are shuffling lines, even without injuries, when coaches are looking to change some things around, you often hear coaches like to at least keep two guys together. Maybe you're switching a winger, or if you're switching a center, you're keeping guys together. Do you think that may go into at least the initial thinking of keeping maybe Aston Reese and Bluger together? So at least they have those two guys have played together. Then you go to the top line, you don't have the center, obviously, but the two wingers have played together. Do you think maybe that goes into a little bit of Mike Sullivan's thinking initially?
Well, I think it's most important to have two guys stay together when one of them is a center. You know, I think when you take the center out of a line, that the wingers don't have the same level of interaction that a center does with each of his wingers. In the case of the Aston Reese and Bluger, they plugged Brock McGinn right into Tanev's old spot.
Sure.
And I think they did that because they, you know, when they signed McGinn, they projected him as a guy that they wanted to see fill that role. So, you know, I wanting McGinn to step into Tanev's spot made it pretty much a natural for them to keep Aston Reese and Bluger together. So, you know, I definitely would expect to see those two, you know, remain a tandem, even if they would ultimately opt against keeping McGinn there.
Sure. And of course, the other thing with Crosby, the hope is that, you know, maybe a couple weeks into the season, he's back, right? So then you're bumping just Carter down. And that's where I get to the point where if you could keep that third line kind of intact, that's one line you're not, that's one less line you're going to have to find chemistry for, because they, you would hope that McGinn kind of melds in with those other two guys, and you, it's one less line you have to kind of fool around with. The other question, getting back to Jeff Carter, who of course had such a strong year at the end of the year, coming in, played well in the playoffs. Is there concern early on in that his minutes are probably going to have to go up, aren't they, Dave? I would think.
Yeah, so certainly if he's in a top six role, or for as long as he's in a top six role, especially when both Crosby and Malkin are out, he absolutely is going to have to play some big minutes. The good news is he would have been able to take that into account during the off season. I'm sure he was aware of at least the possibility that Crosby would be having surgery before it became known that Crosby was having surgery.
Yeah.
And also the Penguins will be able to kind of limit him in camp just to conserve some energy for him. Obviously, you'll want to give him some work with the guys that you project as his line mates, you know, presumably Guentzel and Rust.
Yeah.
But there would be no need to tax a guy who's 36 years old under any circumstances, but certainly not under these circumstances when you're going to lean on him pretty heavily, probably for at least a couple of months.
Yep.
And especially in the early weeks when he's going to be your guy in the middle.
Yeah. The one good thing about Jeff Carter, we'll leave it at this and we'll move on. Like I said, well, at the end of the segment, is that as long as he's healthy, and he had a couple of years there where I don't think his ankle was quite right, but he's a pretty well-conditioned athlete. And I know we're talking about a 36-year-old, but he's in pretty good shape. He's always been a good skater. I think he can handle it. The question is how long he will have to fill that number two role. And again, with Malkin, we're not quite sure. So, all right. Good stuff from Dave here in the second segment. As I mentioned, when we come back, we will be joined by Larry Brooks to preview the New York Rangers season. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast, and we are now joined by Larry Brooks from the New York Post. Anyone who follows 66 to 87 trivia will know Larry was our first guest on the show back in January when hockey restarted last season. So we really appreciate it. Larry, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Just back from my first day at the rink. It was good to be back. It was good to be actually able to speak to players personally and not over a computer screen. So it was a good day. It was good to be back.
Rangers are one of the more intriguing teams in the league. They have gone through a rebuild. They're a young, fast, offensive team that has shown some promise, but that did not stop the ownership from making some serious changes at the end of last season. They cleaned house. John Davidson, Jeff Gorton, David Quinn, the coach, all gone. I guess the first thing right away, Larry, did this group make the right decision here?
Well, I think there was a chasm developed between management and ownership about the actual direction of the program. And when that happens, then it's certainly it's certainly in the team's best interest to have every department aligned. And the owner, Jim Dolan, I think was upset at the team's lack of competitiveness in games against the Islanders last year. I think there was a concern that the rebuild was becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that the team just was not moving ahead rapidly enough. John Davidson had said basically from the day he took the job that this was going to be a very long process. But on the way, the Rangers signed Panarin as a free agent. They traded for Jacob Trouba. And so it wasn't quite a rebuild as it was a rebuild plus a reshaping. They wanted to be able to get back as quickly as possible. And I think a fourth straight year out of the playoffs raised some eyebrows. And listen, it was a surprise. There's no question that it came as a surprise. But the way they played against the Islanders last year was very, very disturbing. And that came on top of the way they were manhandled by Carolina in the bubble play-in. You know, it's really interesting. It's so much of last year goes back to the bubble. You know, that year, the 19-20 year, was a really positive year for the Rangers. And, you know, it was very positive. They brought Shesterkin over in the middle. You know, they brought him over. He came up in the middle of the year. They charged down the stretch. Zibanejad was probably the best player in the world over the final 3 months of the season. And then, of course, there was the pause for COVID. And they, because of the way they charged down the stretch, they were invited to the 2014 plan. And it was actually the worst thing that could have happened to them. For whatever reason, they were not prepared. They were not ready. Their big guys were just snuffed out. They didn't look particularly good in that summer camp, but there was no context to that. And so, you know, then they went to the bubble in Toronto and just blown out in three games. It was clear that they needed to become tougher, and especially so when the divisions were realigned last year and they were caught in this meat grinder of a division where they're going to play the Islanders eight times and the Caps eight times and Pittsburgh eight times. It was a very, very tough division for them, and the Bruins eight times. It was a tough division for them, and they just didn't add any real grit to their team, and their young players were kind of exploited. And their top players just did not play well against the Islanders after they did the year before. So this is a long answer to the question about why the change was made, but that's why the change was made. And a lot of it goes back to the way they were just manhandled in the bubble. And I think that was a real eye-opener for people that they didn't respond by making personnel moves last year. And so they've moved ahead, and listen, there is a terrific foundation left here by Jeff Gorton. There's no doubt. You know, it happens all the time when a general manager is fired for whatever reason, and the successor has immediate success. A lot of that success is due to what his predecessor did, and so, you know, Chris Drury here has been left a great. Great deal of natural resources by Jeff Gorton. And I think too that the decision was made by Drury, who at one point last year was offered an interview for the GM's job in Pittsburgh after Jim Rutherford stepped down. But I think that Drury, and I think he was right in this, believed that this team needed an experienced NHL head coach, someone who had had success in the NHL. After David Quinn, and I thought I think that David deserves another job. I think he did well. I think there were, you know, but I think he was learning on the job. And I think at this point, after being out for 4 years, the Rangers felt they needed someone who was not going to learn on the job, but you know, who had a track record of success in the NHL.
Yeah, we'll get to Gerard Gallant a little bit more in a second, but I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, beyond the shakeups in the management and coaching ranks, you know, what you alluded to, they have made changes to try to add some toughness, some grit to the lineup. What do you make of the moves that they did go ahead and end up making this summer on the ice?
I think they I think they were actually a little less bold than they thought they're going to be this summer. I think there was going to, I thought that there was going to be a pretty dramatic move at the top. Maybe that would have been Eichel. You know, it's unclear how involved the Rangers were, but it's unclear how involved anyone was with this dysfunctional situation in Buffalo. It is almost impossible to get a handle on it. It is one of the worst breakdowns I've seen between a star player and an NHL team in a very, very long time. And the Rangers did have interest in Eichel. How deep it went, I don't know. They were never to the point where they were in a position to ask to see the medicals. So perhaps the Eichel situation put a hold on things, but the Rangers did more work in their bottom six. Their top six is going to be pretty much the same as last year. They'll shift a couple of players around, I think. But it's the bottom six where they went out and got Goodrow, and they went out and got Ryan Reeves, and they went out and got Sammy Blaze, and then on D, they added Patrick Nemeth, and they signed Jarrett Tinordi, presumably to be their seventh. They're trying to bulk up that way, and I think they're necessary moves. I think they probably overpaid for Goodrow, but they didn't really want to get into a bidding war for him, and they had targeted him. He was the guy they wanted. They value his grit, and they value his experience on a back-to-back Stanley Cup champion. And that, you know, the Rangers didn't have a player on their team the last couple of years who had won the Stanley Cup. So I think that was a deficiency. They thought so too, and they addressed it. Blaze they like a lot, and they believe that Ryan Reeves will have value. And when I was talking to Gallant a few weeks ago, he said that when, from his experience as a player, when you have players like that behind you, everyone plays with more confidence. So the effect the Rangers hope that Ryan Reeves has is on Zibanejad and Panarin and players like that who might be given a little more space because Ryan Reeves is going to come on next. And we'll see about that.
You're right. I think you alluded to how well Mika Zibanejad had played in the spring of 2020. The years are starting to run together, but I think it was 2020. Right. what a roaring finish he had. Last year, not so much. A poor start. So the question, Larry, is Mika Zibanejad, in your mind, a first-line center on a Stanley Cup contender? And do you think that the club signs him to an extension? Because I believe he is... Right. Will be an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season.
Yeah, listen, last year, his season last year was ruined by COVID. I think there were other factors, but he contracted COVID a week before training camp started, didn't get on the ice until 3 days before the season opened, and he just had a dreadful first 20-25 games. He didn't look like himself. He did nothing well. It was a major issue. And then as the year went on, he improved a little bit. And then, coincidence or not, David Quinn finally benched him for 10 minutes of a game in New Jersey, which was kind of a shock. I mean, it had been coming for a long time, but it's still a shock to see the first line center and, you know, one of their best two players with Panarin, one of their best two forwards, sitting for 10 minutes. And then about a week or so after that, and again, perhaps coincidence, perhaps not, when David Quinn was sidelined by COVID and Chris Knobloch came up from Hartford to be the head coach for an 8-day period, Zibanejad took off. A pair of hat trick games and 6-point games against the Flyers within like 10 days. And he finished the season not quite the way he did the year before, but he finished it playing very, very impressive hockey. He is a great goal scorer. Do I think Mika Zibanejad at his best is a first line center for a contending team? I certainly do. Do I think the Rangers will sign him? I think they want to. I think they'd like to. I think they would like to sign him to a 6-year deal. He's going to be 29 next summer. So he'll be 29 when his extension starts. He is, I believe, looking for 7 or 8 years. I think I was told at the start he was looking for somewhere around $10 million a year. Certainly, if the Rangers were going to pay Eichel $10 million, you can understand why Zibanejad would want that $10 million. I don't believe that's something the Rangers are comfortable with at this point, 7 or 8 years at $10 million. I think what was interesting was the deal that Couturier signed in Philly, and it surprised me. But Couturier and Zibanejad, over their last four seasons, when they became prominent players, their numbers are almost identical. It's remarkable, the stats. Mika is a better goal scorer, but Couturier has more assists. Their points per game, they're almost mirror images of each other statistically. And Couturier, who's actually a little bit older than Zibanejad, he signed an 8-year deal for $775. And I can't speak for either side, but I think that's something the Rangers would consider, even though they really don't want to go 7 or 8 years at this point. They don't want to extend really any player past the age of 35. But I think if the number, the 775 number, I think works extremely well for them. I'm not so sure the 775 works nearly as well for Zibanejad's side. And the other complication in this, of course, is the flat cap, and the fact that the Rangers are going to be hammered by the cap in 2 years. Adam Fox is going to be coming up next year, and Fox obviously is going to be a $9 or $10 million player. They're going to have Kako coming up. They're going to have Lafreniere coming up in a couple of years. They have a lot of big contracts on their team, and so they have to be careful with what they do with Zibanejad. And the other issue is their second line center, Ryan Strom, is also a pending unrestricted free agent. So they have, their top two centers both are playing on expiring contracts. And that's not an optimal situation for the team.
Larry, you mentioned Kako and Lafreniere, the second overall pick in 2019 and the first overall in 2020, respectively. What do the Rangers have in those two guys?
Well, I think they have a really good player in Lafreniere. I think that, and in fact, watching him today, he is lighter. He dropped some weight. He looked quicker than he was last year. I think that was one of the problems he had last year. But, Lafreniere came in last year without a training camp. There were no exhibition games. It was a bizarre offseason. He was separated from his family for 9 or 10 months. He was drafted in October. I think he came to New York to start training, in late November or early. Yeah, I think so. I think middle to late November. And he did not see his family again until the season ended, which was in the middle of May. So, for an 18, 19-year-old, boy to be separated from his family and from his friends for months wasn't easy for him. And, he had a challenging year. He did. He had a challenging season. Teams were aware of him, but you see his skill, you see his talent, you see his determination. He's going to be a really good player, and he's going to be a real good top six player. Maybe, I think he's going to start on their top line this year. I think that's the plan, to switch from left to right, and he'll play with Zibanejad and Kreider. I think that's the way they would like it to go. And I think he'll fit really well there. Kako has had a couple of years where his development has been pretty slow, and his play away from the puck last year and on the puck last year was improved, but you don't, you're not selected second overall to be a, you know, a good defensive player. He hasn't yet, you know, he won more battles. He was involved in more battles last year than the year before. He hasn't yet shown that he's able actually to break out into open ice, and he plays a lot on the wall, and he's got to get to the front of the net. Now, he looks much bigger. He looks a lot bigger. Of course, every summer you say that, every training camp, you say that about guys. Oh, he's so much bigger. He's so much bigger. But Kakko does look significantly bigger. The question is, for me, is he quick enough to play in this league? You know, can he get to the net? Can he beat guys? And I guess if not, then is he strong enough to bull his way to the front? So we'll see. The first 2 years have not been what anybody expected. There's no question about that. I think the transformation, I think it was a very tough transformation for him from Finland to New York and from the bigger ice to the smaller ice. I think it was a little bit tougher than people might have expected. But he did make a lot of progress last year on his overall game.
And finally, Larry, you mentioned Gerard Gallant earlier. What does he give the Rangers that David Quinn or even anybody who preceded David Quinn didn't?
Well, I think he's very much not necessarily in personality, but in his approach. I think he's very similar to the way Alain Vigneault coached this team. I mean, he is a coach with a proven track record in the NHL. He's not Scotty Bowman. He's not Al Arbor. He's had a couple of, you know, of 3 year experiences, but he gets results. Every place he's been, he gets results, and the players respond to him. And I think that's exactly what the Rangers management was looking for. Someone who would not be questioned, who wasn't going to be, you know, who didn't have the tag of college coach, which I think is just a shortcut criticism from people who just didn't like, you know, a move that David Quinn made or didn't make. But I think he's a player who demands respect. He's a guy who talks the player's language. He seems to be a guy who doesn't pile, you know, doesn't pile rules on these players. And I think they'll respond to him much of the way that the team responded to Vigneault for the first few years. Alain Vigneault was an outstanding coach for the Rangers. He really was. So, I think Gallant is someone who gets respect the minute he walks into the room.
All right, Larry, thank you so much. Anyone who follows the Rangers or follows the league, I mean, Larry's always breaking stories. Follow him on Twitter. Certainly read his columns on New York Post. Slapshots is always a must read for fans around the league. And as always, I love having two Hall of Famers on the same broadcast. So Dave Molinari. And that is it for this week's edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. We will see you again next week here on DK Pittsburgh Sports Podcasting Network.